This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A rogue regime expanding its terrorist acts. The Israeli regime bombed the Qatari capital of Doha on Tuesday. At least 15 Israeli warplanes attacked Doha with 10 bombs targeting the Hamas negotiating team there. None of the team was killed. However, there were other fatalities. This attack is a coordinated U.S., U.K. and Israeli attack on international law, humanity, and the sovereignty of the Qatari nation. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Beirut, author and researcher Daniel Yekic. And out of Bethlehem, university professor, historian, and author Mazen Komsayi. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off in Beirut. And Daniel, I mean, your thoughts about what took place today. First of all, are you surprised at what happened? And I want to talk about the significance of it.
Yeah, I think the timing is, of course, very interesting. But unfortunately, at this point, it would be naive to claim any surprise given the continuous Israeli-American aggression throughout the region, also keeping in mind the Israeli aggression within the last 24 hours within the Tunisian territory, in addition to, of course, to the ongoing bombardment of Lebanon and Syria, in addition to the ongoing genocide in Palestine. So, of course, this is part of the broader Israeli aggression against the region. And if we look at the specific context during the so-called ceasefire negotiations that the Israeli regime is once again using terrorism as a means for not only political sabotage, but also to enforce its hegemony. And it has once again today attacked a sovereign country in coordination and with the support of the United States. And of course, it is important to mention that Qatar is a close ally of the United States. It also has not that openly, but to some extent, ongoing ties with the Israeli regime. So I think it, within, again, the broader context, this once again also shows that the Israeli regime does not know any red lines, that it continues to exist outside of the frameworks of international law and any accountability. And given the fact that it has the full U.S. support, it should not be surprising that it would take such measures and continue to enforce its terrorism that now is also expanding in the region of the Persian Gulf.
And this has been obviously an attack on the sovereignty of the nation of Qatar. Let's talk about that aspect of it. And basically, for most countries, this is a declaration of war. What do you expect, Mazen, as far as reaction from the Qataris?
Well, I was, surprised that Qatar, which mobilized its anti-missile defenses in the case of the Iranian attack on the American base in Qatar, but did not obviously defend its own territories. So that was kind of disappointing that Qatar has not defended its airspace, and we'll watch and see if they will react in any other way beyond words of condemnation, which many other allies of the United States also issued words of condemnation, ranging from Saudi Arabia to United Arab Emirates to Jordan to the Palestinian Authority. All of these allies of the United States have issued words of condemnation. But the world is starting to have a disbelief because there's a disconnect between words and between actions. And as I said, only time will tell if there will be any action. But my suspicion and the suspicion of a lot of people, observers, is that there will not be a reaction beyond those words, and that this will erode the credibility of the government of Qatar. And as far as the United States is concerned, the U.S. has basically outsourced its foreign policy to Israel. No longer does the U.S. have a foreign policy. It's all shaped and run out of Tel Aviv. And so there's not much to be said about the U.S. beyond being subservient to Zionist interests.
Because the White House now is saying that Trump notified Qatar before the Israeli strike on Hamas. I want to pick up on what Mazen said. If this is proven true, the effect that it could have on the regime, as far as losing any type of credibility, it's unbelievable that a so-called ruler or government would be told that their country is going to be attacked and not react.
Exactly. And it's, of course, within the broader context of, if we look at the purpose that these countries serve within the U.S. hegemony in the region, Qatar, also similar to Bahrain, hosts a U.S. military base. It's, of course, economy, its political reach is very much tied to being a, we could actually say, a proxy of the United States. We can't really speak about an allies in this case because there is no equal, but rather a transactional relationship where, of course, the orders and decisions are made in Washington and not in Doha. And so, of course, there is a dependence that these regimes have on the United States and, as a result, of course, on the Israeli regime. And this is why I would assume that these written protests or condemnations that we've seen today would very much be the maximum of any reaction that these regimes could afford against or towards the Israeli regime. And we've also seen the very broad praise of Trump earlier in his second term, now when he visited the Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf, and how he was welcomed there despite, of course, the ongoing genocide. So, of course, there is a capitalist economic interest here that is at the center, and it, of course, overshadows questions about sovereignty. And keeping in mind that in this entire hierarchy of proxies, the Israeli regime, of course, is much more important to the U.S. Than any of the proxy regimes.
Well, Mazen, let's look at this. I mean, the Israeli regime tried to assassinate members of a negotiating team who were there trying to come up with some type of a solution to the genocide taking place in Gaza. How does that affect the overall, if we look at whether we're talking about international law or negotiations to political crises that are being suggested by the United States, because the United States was involved, they knew about what was happening, and they had actually, U.S. President Donald Trump had actually encouraged and the Hamas team to meet and to come up with a solution. So what does this do when the negotiating team, they were not successful, but they were trying to assassinate the whole negotiating team?
Well, I mean, we recall when they assassinated Haniya, who was the chair of Hamas, also in his visit to Iran. And we saw that this was obviously Israel is not interested in any kind of negotiated agreement whatsoever. This fascist, racist, genocidal and egalomaniac government of the state of Israel, as it's called, the regime, is interested in continuing wars because that's the only way it knows. That's that it's in its DNA, and we saw it repeatedly, that even their own statements and their own agreements that they agreed to, the U.S. and Israel, for example, agreement last July 2024, have agreed with Hamas on something, and then they, when Hamas accepted it, they pulled back because they are not interested in returning the prisoners that, or having an exchange of prisoners that leads to ending this aggression. The Israeli regime is interested in continuing this aggression, and it has gotten the green light from the U.S. for the past 23 months, and not just the green lights, of course. They got the weapons, they got the diplomatic cover, the U.N., etc., and tons of money to continue this aggression, not just on the Palestinians, but on nearby countries. And here we just add Qatar, of course, as another country they attacked. So the real question is, will the Arab and Islamic world learn that there's no so-called negotiations with such a rogue state? This rogue state cannot be negotiated with. It has to be, the regime has to be ended, it has to be toppled. There's no way you can have any kind of rational discussion with people who want to destroy 15 million Palestinians and their connectivity to our land. There is nothing to discuss. You have to put them in their place, and that means end the impunity and insist on implementation of international law via sanctions, boycott, divestment, sanctions. That's the only way that these regime leaders in Israel understand is pressure. Without pressure, there's not much to say. So Qatar and all the Arab countries need to take the lesson. You know, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates are not going to be safe if Israel is allowed to win, so to speak, this round against the Palestinians, because they are next. They are next because Israel is intending, and that's what Zionism has said, is to build an empire from the Nile to the Euphrates. It's as simple as that.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Daniel, do you think that this will be a wake-up call for the Arab regimes and other Muslim regimes that have been facilitating the Israeli regime during this whole genocide against the Palestinians, have been helping them basically avoid the boycott or the blockage? Your thoughts, is this going to be a wake-up call for those regimes?
I don't think so. I do not think that it's going to be a wake-up call. On the contrary, I do think that we have to look into to what extent these regimes have been collaborating with the Israeli regime and to what extent their economies, their military-industrial complex are intertwined to a large extent, how these regimes are actually allies of the Israeli regime, in spite, of course, of popular and large public protest against the ongoing genocide. And I completely agree with what the other speaker has said, and also in reference to the Zionist ideology, which has very transparently announced its genocidal conquest over a century ago. And at the core of this issue is the ideology of Zionism, which is a genocidal ideology that seeks to eliminate everything that stands in its way. So there isn't room in this case for negotiations, for diplomatic approaches with the Israeli regime. On the contrary, what we see today, the ongoing bombardments and the expansion, the geographic expansion of the Israeli aggression is a result of the fact that the Israeli regime has been allowed by the international community, including by the dominant Arab regimes, to get away with all of its violations. And even worse, it has normalized this genocide that didn't, of course, start in October 2023, but it has been an ongoing genocide that Palestinians have had to face under the conquest of Zionism. But the Israeli regime has normalized this violence and has done so, of course, to some extent with the help of the Arab regime. So I think what we might see more is, of course, a continuity of this so-called diplomatic approach, where we might see some sort of condemnations, but effectively the fact is that these regimes are collaborating with the Israeli regime and aren't there to oppose it. And if we go back to earlier this summer, of course, the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, the illegal act of war against Iran, and the Arab regime's response to that showed us again very well how they are aligned with the U.S. and Israeli position, and how they did not have any issue with using their air defense systems when Iran was defending itself against the Israeli regime. So I think there's a lot of examples currently and historically that have shown the collaboration between these regimes. So this is why I think that's a structural issue in this case.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, Mazen, as Daniel said, talking about these regimes, he doesn't think it's going to make a difference. But what about the reality is that their own existence is being threatened by the Israeli regime, that if they do not act, if they do not stop, as you said, the greater Israel plan, they will be drowned sooner or later. So what is it, what would it take for them to wake up for their own existential existence?
That's a very good question. How much more can Israel do to keep these Arab regimes following Washington orders, which come, of course, as I said earlier, from Tel Aviv, thanks to the AIPAC and the Zionist lobby, and thanks to blackmail of presidents like Trump via the videos that Epstein produced for the Mossad. So thanks to many other factors that allow the Zionist lobby to control U.S. foreign policy and, by extension, of course, pressure those regimes. I mean, I don't want to make Qatar equal to United Arab Emirates or anything like that. Qatar is still a bit more rational, and they have more likelihood of changing their behavior than, let's say, Bahrain or Morocco or United Arab Emirates. But clearly, the situation is reaching points where it cannot continue anymore. And the world is changing, and these regimes, if they have any advisors that read the cards, so to speak, that understand what's going on, that understand that Venezuela stood up to the United States, and now the U.S. Marines and ships are withdrawing from near Venezuela, that the U.S. could not continue its attack on Iran, that the U.S. is failing against China and Russia and many other countries, that BRICS are rising, the coalition of countries, etc. They should read the cards. They should read what is happening, and they should understand that the world is changing, and they shouldn't be left in the dust having basically capitulated to the Zionists. This is not being on the Zionist card side in the 21st century is not a winning card. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you're on the side of genocide if you do that. You're on the side of genocide. And being on the side of genocide is never a winning card.
Right. Interesting points. And what about that, Daniel? As our guest in Bethlehem has said, if you're supporting the Zionist regime, you're on the side of genocide. So then the question would be, as obviously public opinion has changed, the narrative has definitely changed in dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli situation. And yet at the same time, the Israeli regime seems to continue to up the ante of its terrorist attacks. It didn't have to do this today to the Qatari capital, but it chose to do it as it sees that public opinion around the world is definitely increasing against it. So why? How does Israel benefit from, for example, this type of terrorist act that it did today?
So it is very paradoxical, because there almost seems to be a correlation where, on the one hand, we see an increase in criticism of the genocide being exposed. People around the world, including in Western capitals, millions of people demonstrating against not only the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide, but also against the complicity of their own elected governments. And so the global image in which the Zionist entity has invested so many billions of dollars and propaganda efforts throughout the past decades has been destroyed to a large extent. And the only ones who openly stand on the side of the Israeli regime today are very much small capitalistic elites in certain countries, white supremacists, racists, far-right activists, and people who identify with this genocide and who follow such certain ideologies. And so while on the one hand the Israeli regime's image has worsened, it continues to expand also the geographic extent of its bombardments. And I think it shows us the very globally dangerous era that we are going into, which is that the public opinion doesn't matter to this extent. We also see it in the reactions. If we want to take an example among European governments, that sometimes every once in a while certain countries would issue some sort of condemnation or a claim that they would be thinking about announcing or planning some sanctions as a sort of reaction to the popular protests. But eventually, nothing is being done, and the Israeli regime is able to continue its aggression. So there is a very big discrepancy between popular protests and popular will and what governments eventually decide to do. And we live in times where millions or people can be opposed to genocide, and that won't necessarily change because of the corruption in Western, in Arab elites, in the international community. And so we got to a point where I would argue this, the public image of the Israeli regime isn't even that important for it anymore, because at the same time, what it does through these continuous attacks is that it continues to develop its military-industrial complex. It also, of course, uses Palestine as a laboratory to test weapons, to test AI technologies, which are then marketed for a high price. And so the military and economic so-called safety of that regime is at the end maybe even stronger to some extent, for speaking economic terms, as a result of its ongoing violations of international law.
Mazen, don't you think that at the end of the day, with the continued Israeli terrorist acts, especially, for example, the one that took place today, that it just proves more and more that resistance is the only way to deal with this regime? It assassinates tries to assassinate members of a negotiating team. It assassinates heads of organizations. Is there anything but resistance that can bring this all to an end?
Well, as a political observer, as somebody who reads history, we have never had colonialism and oppression and genocide not faced with resistance. It's not really a choice. It's not a matter of me or somebody else deciding, well, should we resist or should we not resist? Basically, resistance is existence for oppressed people. No matter how the oppression happens and the format of the oppression, from slavery to colonization to military occupation, and there are thousands of examples in history, from Vietnam, of course, to civil rights movement, to others, where clearly oppression leads to resistance. And that's the natural outcome. It's in the DNA of colonialism to produce resistance, because there's no other way. And it's not a matter of choice. This is what colonizers don't seem to understand always. They seem to always think that further oppression will somehow, quote-unquote, quell resistance. And I ask Jewish individual Zionists sometimes that debate with me, I tell them, show me an example where you assassinated a leader of a resistance movement. Doesn't matter if I agree with the political ideology of that resistance movement or I don't, or if anybody else agrees with it or don't, that's okay. Irrelevant. If you kill a resistance leader, does that kill the resistance?
Okay, and I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We'll have to end it right there on that note. We're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Daniel Yegic, author and researcher out of Beirut, Mazen Qomsai, university professor, historian and author out of Bethlehem. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The wise man sees the value in every heart, whether it beats in silence or in the song. Peace and blessings, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of For a Better Life. This is Nahid, having the honor of hosting you on this episode, where we explore values that enrich our lives and strengthen our communities. Today, we will reflect on a subtle but profound virtue, respecting people with different characteristics, whether they are introverted or extroverted, quiet or outspoken, contemplative or energetic. Respect is not only a social requirement, it's the reflection of a spiritual awareness, recognizing that Allah has created each soul with unique strengths and needs. But before we start, let me set a situation into your minds. Remember school and those kids who were always sitting in the last row of the chairs? And those kids were less talkative and were so quiet, didn't want to enter any discussion or challenges at school. Did we consider them as valuable, as worthy of those people around who were so talkative, active, and energetic? Unfortunately, some of us might have the answer of no. I mean, the most talkative person was always valued, while the less talkative and quiet girl or boy who was sitting in a class was not considered with the same scale, on the same scale of being valuable. That's why today we're going to consider this issue on the Islamic point of view and at the same time the literary, wonderful eyes of Sa'di Shirazi. Well, Sa'di in Bustan narrates a story of two travelers, one calm and thoughtful, the other lively and expressive. Both were judged by others as better or worse until a wise elder pointed out, "Every soul has its season, and every temperament its treasure. To honor one is to honor the divine." This story reminds us that differences are not defects. They are divine designs meant to complement the richness of life. The Holy Book of Quran emphasizes the dignity and uniqueness of every human being in this way. "We created you and diverse tribes and nations so that you may know one another." Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam had said, "Whoever guides another to goodness has a reward equal to the one who follows it." Imam Ali alayhi salam instructed, "Do not belittle anyone, for every soul has its own worth in the eye of Allah." So recognizing and honoring differences is therefore both a spiritual and social duty. Now, introverts often reflect deeply, value quiet spaces, and recharge through solitude. Extroverts may draw energy from interaction, thrive in social settings, and express themselves freely. Respecting introverts means giving them space, listening without pressure, and valuing thoughtful contribution. Respecting the extroverts, on the other hand, can mean appreciating their energy, including them in shared activities, and acknowledging their expressive ideas. Islam encourages consideration for every temperament, an echo of the Prophet's teachings to treat all with gentleness. Now, what are some ways and how can I improve my way of connection towards different groups of people? We're going to go for a short break, then come back to talk about those practical ways which can help us all.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back to For a Better Life, where we are talking about different groups of people, be it introverted or extroverted, and how can we value them with the same scale? How can we have no discriminations between the different characteristics of people? Well, the first practical way can be to listen actively, tailoring our approach to each personality, or avoiding labels. Many people just simply label others as shy, outgoing, quiet, extroverted. But we shouldn't dismiss the quietness as weakness or talkativeness as friendliness. So this is very important that we need to stop ourselves as teachers, as co-workers, as colleagues, as friends or classmates who are seeing other people with other characteristics as well. The other way can be encouraging without pressure, respecting their pace of engagement and celebrating their strength, recognizing what each brings to the team, family, or community, and of course, practicing patience. Differences require understanding and humility. Through these actions, we cultivate a society of acceptance, a society of empathy and cooperation. Now, Saadi recounts a scholar who noticed that a silent student often observed more than those who spoke constantly. Recognizing his insight, the teacher honored his perspective. Similarly, Imam Ali alayhi salam treated each companion according to their strength, nurturing diversity while maintaining justice and equality. These examples all show us that respect is adaptive, mindful, and compassionate. Now, respecting the differences is not abstract. It appears in everyday life, like allowing our colleagues their preferred working style, like listening to our family members without rushing them, like acknowledging our friends' way of celebrating or grieving, or even simpler, avoiding the imposing of our style on other people. By respecting differences, we honor Allah's wisdom in creation and strengthen deep human being bonds. As we know, whatever responsibility, whatever job position that we have, as Muslims, we have this responsibility of staying connected, staying brothers and sisters with each other. So my brothers and sisters, please remember in whatever position that you are responsible for the others. Feeling for the others' vibes while they are at the workplace, that you are also there. We can create a better place for them by just simply looking at them and considering them, by trying to be in their shoes, to feel the way they are feeling. If I'm an introverted working with you as my teacher, and you are not recognizing the kind of silence that I need to go deeper into my thoughts and find even more creative ways than my classmates, then this is a problem here. You as a teacher are going to invest some time on understanding me and trying me to improve as part of the Islamic society. As we conclude, remember, every personality is a unique thread in the tapestry of society. Introverted or extroverted, reflective or expressive, each has a role and a purpose. Saadi wrote, "Do not despise the quiet soul, for silence often speaks wisdom beyond words." Similarly, in the same way, extroverted voices, when guided by virtue, illuminate the hearts and unite the communities. So, dear listeners, let your respect extend to every soul you encounter. Greet introverts with patience, embrace extroverts with warmth, and honor all with sincere appreciation. As we part, I leave you this thought. May your heart hold patience, your ears hear with care, your words uplift every spirit, and your understanding of characters echo like a gentle wind of peace. With that, I say, I wish you great connections with every person that you are working with, you are seeing, or you are meeting with. I wish you understanding of different characteristics, and I wish you will be well understood by those who see you with whatever feature that you have. And with the wishes of the best Islamic characteristics to be built in our personalities, until our next episode, I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Bazaar.
Iran has a rich history in weaving carpets, dating back to over 2,500 years ago. Originally, Persian carpets were woven by traveling nomads to cover floors and gears, which are round dwellings that are easily packed up. Persian carpets are adored all over the world. In fact, the most expensive Persian rug ever bought was a 17th century Persian vase-style carpet, which was sold at an auction in 2013 in London for over $33 million. The legacy and tradition of carpet making still remains in Iran, with intricate designs, lavish colors, and peerless artistry.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Bazaar. This week, we will take a look at rural cooperatives in Iran while shining the spotlight on the production of traditional hand-woven carpets. We want to see how they are made and why they are so expensive. Also, we will check out how cooperatives help support this sector, which contributes millions to the economy. So, let's roll out the show.
A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost tens of thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on. But rugs made in Iran's Fars province are perhaps the most traditional carpets characterized by their bold designs. So our journey took us to a cooperative in this province near the city of Shiraz in order to see the production cycle of this valuable handcraft. This cooperative is made up of a chain of related trades for weaving carpets. First, we visited a dyeing complex. This facility is a massive 22,000 square meter area dedicated to boiling, spinning, and dyeing sheep's wool. The processes are all done by hand using natural plant-based dyes. It is probably the largest of its kind in the province and one of the oldest in this field, with over four decades of experience in traditional hand dyeing. One of the advantages of plant-based dyes is that they enrich the quality of wool over time. Plus, they are non-toxic. The facility supplies bright and elaborate yarns to another part of the cooperative, which is dedicated to weaving.
Hand-woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Carpet weaving in Fars is recognized as part of the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage List. In this province, materials are distributed to small villages for women to weave in their homes or in cooperatives. And Fars province is famous for its magnificent Gappe carpets.
This weaving facility gets its supplies and yarns from other parts of the cooperative. Here, we were able to see the process of how carpets are woven. Looms for Gappe rugs are typically laid horizontally across the floor, making their production extremely labor-intensive. The process of weaving a Persian rug differs slightly with each variety, but generally speaking, a bed of foundation material called warp is installed into the frame. Starting at the bottom, weavers then feed wool in between the warp, tying knots on each one. A highly detailed silk rug can have around 170 knots per square centimeter. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather their materials, design, and overall size. While some varieties of Persian rugs follow design specifications, Gappe carpets are often completely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs such as goats, trees, and dolls. This weaving facility also offers training courses for handmade traditional carpets. These establishments are particularly important for women. Much of the traditional carpets woven here are made by the dexterous hands of ladies, which also generates income for them. The This cooperative is one of 1,900 cooperatives scattered around the country. Currently, there are over 100 carpet weaving complexes and over 5,000 centralized and non-centralized workshops nationwide, too. That's based on figures from the National Carpet Center.
Women in rural areas play a key role in the agriculture sector, which provides wool and silk and cotton to weavers. The statistics show there are 10 million rural and nomadic women who contribute to agricultural production in the country. That's around 49% of the entire rural community. And cooperatives help protect the hard-earned income of women as well.
Despite Iran's rich history of producing handmade rugs, the tribal rugs produced in rural villages could be under threat from a lack of young weaving talent. So cooperatives play a big role in reviving and sustaining this ancient tradition. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers, who frequently receive the least amount of profits from their products. This is mainly because there are a lot of middlemen who make money from carpets. With that in mind, cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the chain of production by linking producers of material with weavers and weavers with buyers, which completes a production cycle. There are many opportunities for investment in the field of carpet weaving, especially in the field of dyeing, spinning, and livestock. Millions of Iranians are directly employed in rug making, and many more indirectly. Also, there are numerous export markets available. It might be interesting to know that one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets is the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, due to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find other indirect avenues to purchase the highly coveted carpets, which reduced the profits returning to the country.
Now, hand-woven carpets typically get center stage in the textile industry. But Iran also makes large quantities of machine-made carpets with very high quality. Iran's carpet industry has maintained the integrity of its products while adjusting to modern demands. There are thousands of designs to choose from for nearly all purposes. And Iran also exports its carpets in large quantities.
Iran is one of the top 10 global exporters of machine-made carpets. The major exporters are China, Turkey, India, and Belgium. That's all according to the Ministry of Industry. Based on the same figures, Iran has a potential capacity to produce over 120 million square meters of machine-woven carpets with some 1,300 production units nationwide. Innovation in production has been one of the pillars of speed. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran exported around $110 million worth of machine-made carpets in the first 6 months of this year. So far, carpets have been sent to 54 destination markets around the world. Industry participants say exports could have been higher last year if it wasn't for border closures due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Iran also exports hand-woven carpets. In fact, the statistics from the Customs Administration shows there was a 14% increase since last year. Exports of these items have generated well over $82 million in hard currency in the first quarter of this year. The government has plans to increase its exports through promoting online sales as well as pursuing Chinese markets. Around 3.5 million square meters of handmade carpet are woven in the country each year. That's according to Iran's National Carpet Center. Roughly 80% of carpets produced domestically are exported.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
Have you ever purchased a piece of land on Mars? In the so-called metaverse, you can do that. Metaverse is a subcategory of the blockchain technology where you can practically live in an entirely virtual world. Today, I'll walk you through an Iranian company that has a lot to say in the blockchain industry.
Artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, and blockchain. These are the keywords to unlocking a whole new world called Metaverse, where giant tech brands like Facebook have expressed huge interest in. But perhaps blockchain is the top layer in the new universe. Accochain is one of a myriad of companies that are working to advance the blockchain technology and its amazing subcategory that's called cryptocurrency.
To step into the blockchain business, you'll need to learn the ABC of the market. Without it, you'd most probably face some serious challenges. But don't worry, This company is here to teach you the A to Z of the market.
When talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin is what comes in mind. But a large number of new names other than Bitcoin and Ethereum are emerging on a daily basis. To enter this business, you'll need to attend special courses to analyze the trends of different cryptos. And EchoChain has it all.
One of the major projects undertaken by this company was to create crypto trading bots that can help you buy and sell cryptocurrencies at the right time and with peace of mind.
As humans, we get tired. As humans, we go through emotional burdens, which could overcome our reasoning and lead to an irreparable loss in the hard-to-sketch crypto trends. Using EchoChain program bots, there's no need to fret about our human deficiencies. The Iranian tech company says it seeks to experience all areas of the blockchain technology. It believes if tapped into, the emerging tech can serve human beings to a great extent and make our lives easier. In fact, the blockchain tech was invented to give rise to the best known crypto, Bitcoin. But today, its applications go beyond digital currencies. This Iranian company says a blockchain stores information electronically in digital format. It can be in the form of games, virtual reality, and augmented reality, or any new wild idea, such as metaverse.
The blockchain technology is revolutionizing the way we live, as it easily combines with other high-tech areas, such as IoT, to give rise to new, more complex technologies. In this burgeoning market, in order to survive, companies will need to be innovative and keep tabs on the latest developments. This company says it's already on track.
Well, many thanks for that awesome report. With that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, thank you. Stay safe.